All right. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me here. Today I'm going to talk about some recent work done by the CALAC collaboration on neutrinoless double beta decay from Lattice QCD. I have a pretty extensive intro, but even though I wasn't here, I know that there have been several talks on neutrinoless double beta decay, so I'll try to go through the introduction very quickly. So to begin, on a quark level, neutrinoless double beta decay can be seen in this diagram, where the same neutrino that is emitted during one beta decay is then absorbed in the second. And this can occur because neutrinos have no known charge or additively conserved quantum number. You might say, well, what about lepton number? Well, historically, lepton number was really introduced to explain things like why this process hadn't been seen amongst other processes. And then in the 50s, when we learned that the weak interaction is maximally parity violating, we now know that we can assign a helicity label to each of these neutrinos, and that's enough to tell us why this hadn't been seen, because the second vertex is forbidden by helicity. And then finally, around the turn of the millennium, we learned that, in fact, neutrinos have masses, so that tells us that helicity is not a good quantum number. You can have a mass insertion, which flips the helicity. And that now tells us why we hadn't seen this, because this can happen, but because we need the helicity flip, it's proportional to the effective neutrino mass. So one thing to point out is that while oscillation experiments tell us there are neutrino masses, neutrinoless double beta decay can give us an idea of the absolute mass scale. So I'd like to spend a minute about the seesaw mechanism because it's relevant for what I'm going to be talking about. So now that we know that neutrinos have masses, we'd like to know, are they Majorana or Dirac? And there are reasons to believe that they should be both. The first argument is just that anything not forbidden by symmetry should occur in nature. So if we don't believe that lepton number is a good quantum number, then I consider the standard model to be an effective theory. And the first dimension 5 operator that I can write down using only standard model particles is, in fact, a Majorana neutrino mass. And also, having Majorana masses gives us a nice resolvement of a puzzle of fine-tuning. So, for example, if the neutrinos only had a Dirac mass, then we have to explain why they are so much lighter than all of the other known standard model particles. So the usual picture is, all right, I allow the neutrinos to have both Dirac and Majorana masses. I can eliminate the left-handed Majorana mass because an explicit dimension 3 Majorana mass would violate the electroweak gauge symmetry. If I now diagonalize this mass matrix, I end up with two mass eigenstates. One is a light and one is a heavy. So here I've assumed that the right-handed mass is very heavy because we haven't detected them, so it's somewhere near some new physics scale, and I've expanded about this large right-handed mass. And so we see that the heavy one is proportional to this heavy right-handed mass, while the light one is inversely proportional to it. If I now plug in some numbers, I can take the top mass as a normal standard model mass, and then I assume that my right-handed mass is somewhere near the gut scale, where we expect new physics to come in. Then I end up with a light neutrino mass, which is about 0.05 eV, which is consistent with the mass splitting from oscillation experiments, and well within the current bounds that we expect. Of course, if we have a large contribution for lepton number violation, we know that the standard model through anomalies can translate this into baryon number, so this is why we are very interested. It could be a source for baryogenesis. I'm not going to talk about experiment except to point out that we really do need nuclear environments to see this, because we need a case where single beta decay is forbidden and double beta decay is not. Otherwise, the single beta decay would swamp the signal. Okay, and neutrino experiments have the best pictures, so I like having this slide. All right, so now let's get down to the new stuff. How can Lattice QCD contribute to our understanding? So first, this is the generic paradigm for how lattice QCD is going to contribute to nuclear physics. We can't put germanium on the lattice for many reasons. So what we can do is we can start from quarks and gluons and calculate few nucleon matrix elements, and then these can then be matched on to bigger calculations in order to translate them into some nuclear matrix elements. All right, so the standard picture for neutrinos double beta decay, the one that we usually think of, is where we have exchange of a light neutrino going on in here. So at the level of the standard model, at the level of quarks, this is very well known. It's related to GA. So what can we do that's new here? You might think about looking into calculations of so-called GA quenching, so the in-medium effects that change the value of GA. And so this is some work that I believe is being pursued by the MPL-QCD collaboration. You can put down a few nucleons and then measure the axial current. And you might want to put in some non-zero momentum because the neutrino with double beta decay can have a much larger momentum transfer than single beta decay. But I should point out that these corrections are really precision corrections. And at the moment, since the understanding of the nuclear matrix elements that come from the truncation of the nuclear wave function are pretty large. So until we can get those better under control, these kind of effects won't come into play. On the other hand, short-range contributions are essentially unknown. So here is somewhere where the lattice can really make an impact. So for instance, if instead of a light neutrino in this diagram, I have, say, a heavy right-handed neutrino, which I talked about with the seesaw mechanism, then you might say, well, this diagram is going to be suppressed by the inverse of this heavy mass because I have a heavy propagator in here. But remember from the seesaw mechanism or from the effective field theory argument where your coefficient was suppressed by the scale of the heavy physics, this guy is proportional to the light neutrino mass, which is also proportional to the inverse of the heavy mass. So it's really unclear which of these is going to dominate until you actually calculate them. And I should point out, one other thing, it doesn't even have to be neutrinos that are propagating through those diagrams. There are various other particle physics models, such as supersymmetric models. So this is an R-parity violating supersymmetric diagram. And R-parity is important to invoke if you want your lowest superpartner to be stable, and this is often used as a dark matter candidate. So if we do see neutrinoless double beta decay and we can say that it actually occurred through exchange of selectron, then we might be able to use it to constrain the R parity violating coefficients. And again, no matter what is happening in this diagram, even if there are no neutrinos at all, observation of neutrinoless double beta decay automatically implies a Majorana neutrino mass. Because of this black box theorem where I can always rearrange this diagram with some neutrinos on either side and that generates a neutrino mass. All right, so let's go a little bit more into detail about the steps in going from the standard model to a nuclear matrix element. So we start with your favorite BSM theory, and you can, by hand, integrate out all of the heavy particles that are occurring in here. And you can write down a set of four quark operators in QCD. There have been 9 of them that have been tabulated in this work by Professor Ramsey, Musoff, and Vogel. And these account for almost all of the ones we have to consider. There are a few more, which I'll mention later. These are categorized by parity, which is a good quantum number in QCD. And then they're also labeled by the different chiralities, whether you have a left-handed current turning into a right or left-to-left, et cetera. And then finally, according to Dirac structure, there are a couple of vector operators here. All right, so lattice QCD, we're going to take quarks and gluons and we're going to create 2 nucleon states out of them. And then we're going to calculate matrix elements with these 4 quark operators to calculate 2 nucleon amplitudes. And then again, this can be fed into a bigger nuclear physics calculation. So before we even begin to do a lattice calculation, which is very difficult, we can try to categorize which of these two nucleon amplitudes are going to be the most important according to chiral perturbation theory, which has the neutrons and protons as the explicit degrees of freedom. And this was, again, done in the Prezzo, Ramsey, Musoff, and Vogel paper. So the leading order exchange actually doesn't have the neutrinos double beta decay occurring on the nucleons at all. The nucleons exchange a pion, and then the neutrinos double beta decay changes a pi minus to a pi plus. And this is the leading order because the pions are light degrees of freedom in chiral perturbation theory. And so each time you have a pion propagator, you get an enhancement of order p to the minus 2. At the next order, we have a vertex where the decay occurs at the vertex between the nucleon and the pion. This has one fewer pion propagator, so it's going to be order p to the minus 1. And then finally, we have a two-nucleon contact operator. And since we have no pion propagators, this is just order p to the 0 in our chiral counting scheme. So we're going to concentrate on this operator because it's leading order and because, as I'll explain, it's actually very, very easy to calculate on the lattice. And the key is to note that we don't actually have to calculate a two-nucleon amplitude at all, because this low energy constant, which is the piece that's missing, I can calculate by just looking at a transition between a pi minus and a pi plus with the four quark operator inserted in there. So that's what we're actually going to do. We're going to calculate a pi to pi matrix element and then stick this unknown LEC into chiral perturbation theory to determine the two nucleon amplitude. And this is great because pion physics on the lattice is beautiful. This was actually my first time doing a pion calculation on the lattice. I usually look at nucleons, and I was just, it was beautiful. So one of the reasons, which I'll explain in a minute, is it's very cheap to create these. There's no signal-to-noise problem, which is the biggest hindrance to looking at nucleon physics on the lattice. Furthermore, this is also the easiest matrix element to calculate because it's an isospin changing 2 operator, so there are no disconnected pieces. We've heard about the disconnected contributions where you have to calculate these loops that connect to the operator insertion and they cost a volume in the computation time, and we don't have to calculate any of those. All right, so back to our picture. I just want to emphasize exactly how we're doing this. These are done by hand. We now are going to use lattice QCD to go from four quark operators to pi to pi plus matrix element. We then stick that into chi-pt to determine the two nucleon amplitude. And then finally, nuclear physics tells us decay rates. All right. So first, let's determine which of these operators we actually have to calculate. They can be further organized by chiral perturbation theory, which was done in this table here. So we're interested in just the two pion contributions. So we only have to look at parity even operators. The parity odd ones will be 0. Furthermore, all of the vector operators you can show by looking at the effective Lagrangian to be suppressed by the electron mass. So we're going to completely disregard them for our calculation. And then we have the chiral counting, leading order, and NNLO. You can see that this O3 operator, and O3 was the one that connected right-handed currents to right-handed currents and left-handed to left-handed currents, has no contribution at leading order. However, depending on whatever your particle physics model is, it's actually unclear a priori which is going to be most important. So for example, in left-right symmetric models with no mixing between the left and right-handed bosons, this is the only one that contributes because O's 1 and 2 change left-handed to right-handed currents. In currents with mixing, the relative importance of these operators is determined by the mixing angles and the masses of the W's, and so it's really, depending on your model, you can see that any one of these operators could be the most important. So these are the ones we're going to calculate. Okay, so here's our setup. So we create a pion interpolating field at some time. It's basically just the QQ bar pair of the right isospin. And we propagate this state through imaginary time in order to eliminate excited state contamination. And then we're going to hit it with the operator, and we're going to do the same thing backwards in time with another one. And again, if I separate these far enough, then I can assure that I've eliminated all of the excited state contamination. And each of these quarks carries a spin and a color index. So here we see that there's going to be another set of operators which were not originally considered, which are the so-called color mixed ones. So where the spin from one quark is contracted with a different quark in the four-quark operator as the color. These don't occur at the electroweak scale, but since we have to do renormalization from the QCD scale to the electroweak scale, these operators are going to mix. So O1 is going to mix with the color mixed version of O1 prime, and we're going to have to figure out what that mixing is. Right, so these are for the lattice people in the audience. These are some details of the calculation. So these Hiske ensembles are publicly available, which is why we use them. They have several different lattice spacings, volumes, and pion masses so that we can look at all of our systematics one by one. And we use domain wall fermions, and the important thing about that, so we use those for our valence quarks. And that's important because, remember, those operators were organized by chirality. Domain wall fermions have good chirality at fixed lattice spacing, so we don't have to worry about unphysical mixing between the different operators. And then finally, we use two different types of interpolating fields for our pions, just so that we can see if we can see any difference in the excited state contamination from those. And also note, we've been seeing talks earlier today, we only have 1,000 configurations with one source per configuration. And this is a very tiny ensemble, and this is only because we're looking at pion physics. And really, we only needed 1,000 because that was necessary for the central limit theorem to apply. All right, so here are some examples of some signals. So this is actually at the physical pion mass. Pions are so clean that we can already just go right to where we want to be. This is a 3D plot where I've plotted both the time between the source and the four-quark operator, and also the time between the four-quark operator and the sink. And you can see that excited state contaminations die off very quickly in both directions. This is the same data plotted just on a 2D plot, so I'm only plotting one time direction, and then the other times are all plotted on top of each other in the TF direction. So you can see that essentially we see no excited state contamination. Our interpolating fields do a very good job, and we can get a nice clean signal even at physical pion mass. And then also our two different sources, our two different types of pion interpolating fields, again, they show us no variation, so we can neglect the excited state contamination. Right, so here are some preliminary results on that same ensemble for all of our different operators. And the colors don't show up very great here, but I've color-coded them according to which ones mix. So this guy is going to mix with this guy, and this guy is going to mix with this guy. And then this was O3. And then remember that I said that O3 had no leading order contribution. It only shows up at NNLO, and in fact, we see that it is about two orders of magnitude smaller than the other ones, so this agrees with what we expected. All right, we can look at a finite volume study. There was a set of ensembles with a fixed lattice spacing and pion mass, but at three different volumes for each of our operators, and we see essentially no variation with the volume, so I think finite volume corrections are under control. And then again, to zoom in on O3 because it's so small, still no finite volume corrections. All right, so here I've plotted results from all the ensembles in that table that I showed you on top of each other. So you do see some variation, especially at the heavier pion mass. And this is, again, we believe that the finite volume errors are under control, so this is likely due to discretization. These are different lattice spacings. But you should take this difference with a grain of salt. We haven't performed renormalization of these operators, and we also haven't determined the mixing between the two different operators. So I can't really comment too much on discretization now, but that is something we are going to study more in the future. And again, here is the O3, and we see fewer discretization effects here. What I can do is just a very naive extrapolation in pion mass. So this is not the actual quantity calculated in Chi-PT. There will be chiral logs that we haven't taken into account here. But this is just a generic polynomial counting in MPi. For operators 1 and 2, again, they have a leading order contribution. So there will be a constant, and then there will be some quadratic pion mass. And you see that not only do these fit very well, so the chiral perturbation theory seems to agree with what we find, but also the shapes of the different operators that are going to mix are very similar. And then for O3, this one had no leading order contribution, so we should fit it to a quadratic plus a quartic, and this fits very nicely with that. All right, so to summarize what I've talked about so far, neutrinoless double beta decay obviously is very important, and there's a huge experimental effort underway, and I believe that lattice QCD can really make a big impact in trying to disentangle the short range versus the long range effects. I've shown you some preliminary results for the leading order pi to pi matrix elements at multiple pion masses, including the physical point. And again, everything that we see seems to be consistent with our expectations. So the big to-do right now is renormalization. So the renormalization is known in MS-bar to two loops, I believe, but we're going to do some non-perturbative renormalization to match on to the MS-bar scheme. And then we need to do a real extrapolation in pion mass from Chi-PT. And then finally, these other contact operators. So I talked about the leading order pion exchange contribution. But again, once these things are put into big nuclear codes, things that you expect to dominate don't necessarily dominate. So we should actually calculate them all. All right, so this one is almost complete. We should have that done hopefully in the next few months. This order that should be a p to the minus one. So the next order, unfortunately, contains disconnected diagrams in here. So again, these cost factors of the volume and computation time. We don't want to have to calculate them. But for once, nature was kind. And so the most often studied transition is a 0 plus to 0 plus. And this is a parity odd operator, so it's not going to contribute. So we don't actually have to calculate it. So what remains are the two nucleon contact operators, and we do plan to calculate these. And I can show you a little bit about the setup there. So here, the picture is much more complicated for many different reasons. One is there are lots more quarks, which means lots more contractions. And then now we actually do have to deal with the baryon signal-to-noise problem. And the excited state splittings between two nucleon states are very small, so it's very difficult to extract a ground state. But these are all things that we're exploring right now and looking at NN scattering. But a big difference is that if you remember the picture that I showed before of the pi to pi matrix element, all of the quark lines from our initial pion source were tied to our four-quark operator. And for that reason, we were able to fully project onto momentum space at both our source and our sink. And we could control both the total and the relative momentum. So here we can't, and the problem is that some of the cork lines go through the operator and some go to the source and the sink. And if you imagine trying to project both the source and the sink onto momentum space, that means you have to calculate all-to-all propagators. And those are, just like disconnected diagrams, are very expensive. So we don't want to do that. So what we have to do is construct sources in position space and then hope to stochastically project onto momentum in the end. So we've done some studies for pure position state operators for just two nucleons in a box. So we're not looking at the matrix element, we're just looking at energy levels and seeing if we can get the ground state with the operators that we've produced. By far, the cheapest and the easiest thing is just to put your two nucleons on the same point, because then you only have to calculate one nucleon block, and then you can tie it up with a copy of itself. There are far fewer contractions and far fewer inversions that you have to do. So here I'm comparing the data for momentum space source, which we know is able to actually get the correct ground state, with our position space local to local sources. And you see that you really never reach this value. So excited state contamination is just too big here. Unfortunately, that would be very helpful if we could use those. So what you have to do is you have to displace your nucleons by very large values. This makes sense. We're looking at low energy scattering states, so having two nucleons on top of each other is not a very good guess for what the wave function might be. And we do actually, we are actually able to reach the correct ground state with these operators. And these were developed in work on NN scattering, also by our group. Finally, because these are two nucleon states in a finite box, spherical symmetry is not a good symmetry. And so a lot of theoretical work has to be done to translate these two nucleon states in a finite volume to the appropriate infinite volume matrix element. Fortunately, that work has been done, so that is ready for us. And again, I mentioned that the renormalization was done for in the MS bar scheme for our pi to pi element. It has also been done for these two nucleon elements. So all of the theory is there waiting, and we just need to calculate. So stay tuned for hopefully new results on that.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Amy, very much. So I had a question on the zero plus transition. You talked about the order p to the minus one term not contributing because it was parity violating, right?
Parity odd.
But at subleading order, if you have a gradient coupling, you would actually conserve, right?
Yeah.
And that would be the same order as your contact interaction, wouldn't it?
Would it be?
It's just one derivative.
One derivative, yeah.
Yeah, so you probably have to do that too.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, thank
you. Question or comment? So I have a question. In your talk, you said you use gradient flow.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But in this case, you have to change the renormalization of the operator, or?
We used gradient flow just for smearing the configurations.
Yes.
Yeah, so
you calculate operator on this configuration.
Right, so when we're gonna do the non-perturbative renormalization on configurations.
I'm afraid I miss a simple point. I would just like to understand how I back out from this discussion, how your computations, low energy coefficients differentiate between new physics forces of zero neutrinos double beta decay. Ultimately, it seems to me if I have either light Majorana mass or some heavy object which violates lepton number, mm-hmm. and ultimately they will give rise to similar sets of low effective operators at low scales. And so once I finish this, but yet I also know from Jonathan Engel's talk that, in fact, the nuclear structure problem for whether I had heavy Majorana exchange or a light Majorana mass were different. So I don't see how that difference manifests itself in your analysis. And I just somehow end up thinking that I've only seen part of the answer.
Okay.
And perhaps you can clarify that point.
So if I understand what you're asking correctly, so with the light neutrino exchange, I can't integrate out that light neutrino to generate a four quark contact operator. So it looks very different.
I understand the relationship between the broader discussion of possibility and what you precisely presented to us. So then maybe the way to say it is that this analysis presupposes a particular down-select, a new physics mechanism for which these particular effective operators would be appropriate.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, I guess the hope is that future experiments will be able to do some tracking to see if the electrons came from a point or from a long-distance operator, and then you could maybe try to disentangle them.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
It's impossible. It's all happening within the nucleus.
Yeah, it's not that long, but sure.
Any other questions? I think there is an announcement after that, but let's thank.
Oh, I'm sorry, my collaborators. I would like to thank them as well. Okay.
Yeah, we have a rare opportunity to embarrass Joe Carlson. So this announcement just came last night from the APS, and Joe's been named the 2017 APS Hermann Fischbach Prize winner in theoretical nuclear physics. The citation says, for pioneering the development of quantum Monte Carlo techniques to solve key problems in nuclear structure physics, cold atom physics, and the dense matter theory of relevance to neutron stars. So.